We'd lose all of our gas revenue and a good chunk of our oil, about a third of our oil revenue. We'd be better off to shut the gas line down.
Lawmakers react to the governor's first veto. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 29th of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a school science project that could lead to cheaper energy.
There's definitely commercial applications for us. It can be used all anywhere, pretty much.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by BP, unlocking Alaska's energy potential.
Governor Sean Parnell today vetoed the bill that would have separated oil taxes from natural gas taxes. It was originally proposed after economic analysts found that under current market conditions and taxes, the state risked losing as much as $2 billion a year in revenue once gas is in the pipe. In vetoing it, the governor said it was the equivalent of a tax increase on the oil industry.
It also destabilizes our economic environment as we're headed into two open seasons. And finally, our Attorney General's opinion was that it was not necessary at this time, that at any time across the next 10 years, the legislature has the ability to change tax regimes. And so there's no reason to change it now and then change it again later after the open seasons.
The veto came the day before TransCanada Pipeline and ExxonMobil begin the first open season offering shipping rights on a state-licensed gas line from the North Slope to Canada. The state's AGIA statutes guarantee there will be no change in the tax structure for the first 10 years of the line's operations. The principal supporter of the bill, Senate Finance Co-Chair Sitka Republican Bert Stedman, says the bill was trying to avoid that lockdown by removing the quandary of combined oil and gas taxes that in effect subsidize each other.
The net effect of the Treasury is substantial reduction. Erasing under the current environment today of $80 oil and a little over $4 natural gas, we'd be losing a couple billion dollars a year or more. We'd lose all of our gas revenue and a good chunk of our oil, about a third of our oil revenue. We'd be better off to shut the gas line down.
With the tax guarantees going into effect for those who accept the first open season offering tomorrow morning, Stedman says it's too late for any further legislative action. He says the anomaly in the tax structure still needs to be fixed, but it will not likely come before the legislature until tax decisions need to be made on the project.
In the future, when there is fiscal terms brought into the legislature from whoever the administration is at the time, I think the legislature's ability to understand the complexities of the oil and gas interrelationship is substantially advanced, and that the future governor is going to have a very difficult time selling the legislature on a proposal that impacts the Treasury at such a severe impact that we'd be better off not even building the gas line.
The bill became the most controversial measure before the legislature this year and only passed in the closing hours of the session. Some Cordova students are tapping lake mud to generate energy. The local science club project is an Alaska takeoff on manure-based methane systems commonly used for cooking fuel in the world's temperate zones. The high school students presented their research at the Rural Energy Conference in Fairbanks this week. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Tank-based digester fuel systems traditionally use cow manure to break down organic matter and produce methane, but they don't work at cooler temperatures. The bacteria in cow manure just stops functioning, so the Cordova kids are trying an alternative, bacteria-rich Alaska lake mud. Ben Americus of the Cordova Science Club says locals' experience igniting methane from holes in lake ice spurred interest in the more cold-hardy bacteria source.
Like, so we light the methane bubbles all the time, like in the lake. So we thought, like, this makes methane. Like, these digesters don't work in the northern climate, so we can just combine these two things and make methane in the digesters with the lake mud.
The Cordova Science Club project is funded with a $250,000 Denali Commission grant. The research builds on work by 2009 National Geographic Emerging Explorers, T.H. Culhane of the University of California, and Katie Walter Anthony of the University of Alaska. The researchers and Cordova High science teacher Adam Lau are guiding the study. Student Aaron Hess explains how the kids have set up to test the viability of using Alaska lake mud as a bacteria source to produce methane.
We built the digesters first, and so we set up all the tanks, and then we cored mud from the bottom of the lake. So we looked for those methane holes in the lake, and we took some mud from the bottom of it, and we put it in the digesters and put some water in there too, and let it sit for a while just so it could get up and going and get used to it and get producing methane, and then we started feeding them.
Hess says they take food waste from the school cafeteria and add it to the vats of lake mud. The bacteria breaks down the food and turns it into methane gas that can be tapped for a cook stove, heating appliance, or even power generation. Hess says they've successfully burned methane from their system, but are working to fine-tune how much to feed the bacteria to maximize gas production.
We know that they can produce methane, but we think we just kind of overstuffed it with food, so it just stopped working for a while because the pH levels went really low. And so we're just trying to get it back up to the normal level so that it can get going again, and then we can feed it a little more once it's comfortable, and then it can get to producing more methane.
The students are comparing the lake mud bacteria's performance with that of cow manure and a mix of both bacteria types in separate tanks inside a Connex box that serves as their research lab in Cordova. Ben America says if the technology proves up, the lake mud-generated methane could have many uses.
There's definitely commercial applications for us. Like, if we can get ours going, we can heat the school with it, and people all around town can get them for their houses, and it can really, it can be used all anywhere, pretty much.
The kids hope to start by firing stoves and ovens at the Cordova school cafeteria with methane. Their work has already inspired a local pizza shop to use one of the digester systems. The cold, hardy lake mud bacteria could offer a methane energy source to many cooler parts of the globe where manure-based systems don't work. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Thousands of miles away from the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Washington, D.C., prominent environmentalists and members of Congress kicked off a celebration of the refuge today. They're marking 50 years since the region first became a federally protected area under President Dwight Eisenhower. Since then, its coastal plain has been a battleground between environmentalists and pro-development forces eager to explore for oil and gas. Senator Tom Udall of New Mexico says he believes now, with a Democratic-led Congress and White House, the Arctic Refuge could get complete protection.
I always think that on this issue we've been building momentum, and we're working hard. This anniversary, I think you're going to see a variety of things happen in Alaska, outside Alaska, that show we're building momentum. And this group here today, speaking from the heart, really brings home the message.
But the Alaska delegation was noticeably absent from today's gathering. They want the coastal plain open to development and battle efforts to tighten protections. Tom Udall says that doesn't mean there should be an impasse.
The Alaska delegation has to balance everything in Alaska, and that's very, very important. But sometimes the nation also has to act in its best interest. So that's what I think we have to do with the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Alaskan Lucy Beach, the executive director of the Gwich'in Steering Committee in the Interior, spoke at today's gathering. She often travels to Washington to fight efforts to open ANWR to development.
It's a different feeling to be here, to be celebrating the Arctic Refuge. And there is so much to celebrate. Right now, the porcupine caribou herd is beginning their migration to the calving and nursery grounds, to the birthplace. And it's one of the longest migrations of any terrestrial mammal in the world. And we have that to claim in Alaska and in this country.
The 50th anniversary celebration of ANWR continues through December 6th, the date President Eisenhower established the original refuge area. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the unique training style of Iditarod champ Martin Boozer.
I turn him loose and I say, if you want to go somewhere else where you can find it better, please feel free to go. So I turn the whole kennel loose and they all stick around. And I take that as a compliment.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Find qualified Alaskans to fill your company's job vacancies at Alexis, the state of Alaska's virtual career center. Alexis has hundreds of workers for you to browse through, and you can specify details about required levels of experience and other qualifications. Learn more at alexsys.alaska.gov or visit any Alaska job center. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
The University of Alaska's Marine Advisory Program stands a good chance of getting the money it needs to keep offices open in 5 remote coastal communities, including Petersburg. After hearing extensive public support for the program, the legislature budgeted roughly half the amount needed. The university has agreed to match that funding if the governor approves it. From member station KFSK, Matt Lichtenstein has this update.
The program's rural offices in Nome, Dillingham, Petersburg, Cordova, and Unalaska faced closure mainly because of declining money from the federal government and other sources. Supporters appealed to the legislature for help, a lot of supporters, from fishing and economic development groups to school districts and municipalities. A conference committee of House and Senate lawmakers ultimately agreed to include $300,000 in the state's operating budget. Anchorage Representative Mike Hawker, the committee co-chair, highlighted that decision on the House floor during the last day of the session.
And the single item that I probably received more communications on in this entire legislative session than anything else, we found a way to fully fund the University of Alaska's Marine Advisory Program. It's the small things that matter, sir.
The $300,000 from the legislature is just under half the amount Marine Advisory Program officials said was needed to keep all of their remote offices open. However, the university agreed to match that amount for a total funding package of $600,000, just $14,000 shy of the original request. Susan Henricks is the provost at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
The university thinks the Marine Advisory Program is a real asset to the state and to the university as well. And so in the course of negotiations with the legislature, we did agree to fund the other $300,000 of a total request of about $600,000 if the legislature would appropriate $300,000. And we're going to be securing that money by internal reallocation.
The Marine Advisory Program has been in place for 45 years. It has a total of 10 offices and 16 staff members around the state. The Extension Service is best known for the educational, research, and regulatory help they provide to fishermen and other small marine-related businesses. Program Director Paula Cullenberg is optimistic those services can continue.
I'm hopeful that at the end of this whole long process, we will be able to make the 5 positions, the Nome, Dillingham, Unalaska, Cordova, and Petersburg positions, permanent university positions, so that those communities know that they are going to have a MAP agent in their region for the long haul.
It's not yet clear whether there'll be enough money to reestablish the office in Kodiak, which has been closed for more than a decade. The remaining rural offices provide a human connection to the statewide university system. Cullenberg credits the public for convincing lawmakers of the program's value in their communities. This all hinges, of course, on Governor Sean Parnell's final approval of the operating budget, which includes the Marine Advisory money. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Some seasoned Alaska Native leaders are looking for young Natives to fill their shoes when the time comes. At a recent forum, they invited Native students at the University of Alaska Anchorage to find out about leadership skills and urged them to step up to the plate. As part of our series on Alaska Native education, KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has the story.
Leadership roles are earned, but sometimes leaders themselves are surprised at how it all comes about. Liz Medicine Crow from CAKE is Tlingit and Haida. She plays a strong role as vice president of First Alaskans Institute and wears a second hat as director of the Alaska Native Policy Center. She says both her organizations have a clear mission to advance Alaska's Native peoples, but Medicine Crow says she thinks of herself as a worker bee, not a leader.
The work that I do was born out of the love that I have for my people. And even that wasn't something that came from me, that was something that was given to me as a gift from my parents, who received it as a gift from their parents. And I try to remember as I'm walking through every day that I am surrounded by my ancestors. And sometimes that means that I can't make a mistake without somebody's eyes on me. And without somebody drawing it to my attention. But it also means that I don't make a mistake without someone standing behind me and holding me up.
Medicine Crow was one of several Alaska Native leaders who spoke at a recent Alaska Native Youth Leadership Forum in Anchorage. She told them that leadership is not easy.
We are not individuals. We are a community and we are a collective. And that means that whatever is best for the people is the best thing to do. And sometimes that hurts a little bit. And understanding that sometimes it's okay to let go of something you feel really strongly about when the wisdom and the guidance of your elders in the room are asking you to do something else and to step aside from what you think is best. What do your people need? How can you help them get that?
Medicine Crow told the students that Western culture does not teach these values, but Alaska Native culture does. She related stories from her own childhood about how patient elders did not criticize or boss, but quietly showed the correct way by example.
But most importantly, what I learned was how leaders teach leaders. You bring them up next to you. You stand by their side and you work with them.
Nelson Angapak related a story from his days in boarding school when he was 13 years old and not able yet to speak English. But when he spoke in his native Yupik to another boy,
the teacher got so angry, took a 12-inch ruler with a brass edge, hit me so hard that I still have that scar when I went home that spring. I told my grandfather this. I am quitting school when I am 16. He was silent for a moment. And this is what he said to me. I am hoping that someday that you will learn enough of this tongue so that you can tell these white eyes, meaning white people, that we are people. People just like them. With feelings.
Angapak said he had a hard time making the decision, but in the end he listened to his grandfather and went back to school. Angapak said his grandfather and his father did not speak English, but their wisdom was respected. And when a school was built in their village in 1960, it was named after them. He said things get done step by step, one small step at a time. He said the ability to listen is one quality necessary for leadership. Tenacity is another. Yupik author Harold Napoleon said the need for young Native leaders is becoming urgent.
And we're living at a time as Native people when we really don't have the time to raise up the leaders. We don't have the time to raise them up leisurely.
He told the students they can start now, not when they graduate. Napoleon told the students how elders of the Oglala Sioux defined young leaders.
Be big-hearted men, always helping others, never thinking of yourselves. Look out for the poor, for the widows, the elders, and the orphans, and for those of little power. Help them. Think no ill of others, nor see the ill that they would do to you.
Napoleon said the challenges are great. 62% of children in state custody are Alaska Native children, and Alaska Native youth take their lives at 9 times the national average. He told the students that it will become their job to fight for Native survival.
You could become lights in your family. You could be that light in Kaskang. You could be the hope of your village. And that's how you do it. This is the way you do it. It's not hard and it's not complicated. This is what they told us as young people, as children. A leader is a servant. A leader is a servant.
The leadership discussion was part of the Warriors for a New Era series of forums exploring young Alaska Native leadership potential. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by The University of Alaska Southeast, providing the challenge, the balance, the community, offering new degrees in geography and environmental studies and resources. Information at uas.alaska.edu. Volunteer firefighting is a rewarding and extraordinary way to serve your community. It takes dedication, sacrifice, leadership, as well as mental and physical stamina. Emergency calls throughout Alaska continue to rise, but the number of volunteer firefighters continues to decline. Learn how you can experience the excitement and satisfaction of becoming a volunteer firefighter. Visit asfafireline.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska State Firefighters Association.
Obama administration drug czar Gil Kerlikowske kicked off an anti-methamphetamine advertising campaign targeting Native American youth yesterday. The ads will appear in Alaska and 14 other states with high Native populations. The Office of Drug Control Policy has been trying to put its emphasis on prevention rather than cutting off supplies. Kerlikowske says meth is a drug that can be locally manufactured.
You can make the methamphetamine in a variety of ways, and that's why we think spending dollars on prevention will be key.
Meth use among Native American youth is estimated to be about twice the national average. The Alaska State Survey of Student Drug Use does not break out the Native population, but as of 2008 showed a higher rate of meth use among students in the rest of the country. Kerlikowske was accompanied by tribal officials as he unveiled the ads in New Mexico. This is what they sound like.
Where's your all-star cousin, bro? He's all jacked up on meth. Can't even ball anymore.
Dang, you're better off getting hooked on fry bread.
We need res ball. We don't need meth.
There are lots of cool things about being Native. Meth isn't one of them.
Learn more at abovetheinfluence.com.
About $100,000 of the media buy will be spent in Alaska. Past campaigns have used radio and billboards. This one will add television. Kerlikowske says they did market testing before they released the ads.
The ads are designed by a Native American advertising firm, and they were tested with these groups also. So they're pretty specific to that culture, and they build upon that Native American pride also. So these aren't the scare tactic types of ads. The other part is, of course, just a lot of parents and a lot of elders don't talk to young people at all about drugs, and this helps to start the conversation.
The campaign will run through the summer. Four-time Iditarod champion Martin Boozer has great stories to tell, but it's his dogs that capture your heart. That was the case yesterday when a kennel of Boozer sled dogs showed up on the lawn of Centennial Hall in Juneau. Boozer was inside, speaking to a ballroom full of young people and Rotarians about goals and hard work. When he was through, it was the dogs' turn. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander reports.
Martin Boozer says dogs are eternal children. And at yesterday's meeting in downtown Juneau, everyone was ageless.
You're so pretty. Can you say hi?
How are you guys doing? Oh, you're good-looking dogs. Good-looking dogs.
He reached up and kissed me in the face. It was so cute.
These young sled dogs in training were getting the same treatment their Iditarod counterparts get after the race is over. Rubs and hugs from well-wishers at the end of the trail. The Swiss-born musher holds the fastest time for the race from Anchorage to Nome, covering the 1,150-mile Iditarod Trail in 8 days, 22 hours, 46 minutes, and 22 seconds, set in 2002. While he's run the race 27 times and won it 4 times, he told the youth at the Pillars of America luncheon that he never forgets he's also a 23-time loser. Boozer talks to a lot of young audiences each year and often asks them,
"What are you proud of?"
Inspirational speakers at luncheons like these often say you can do anything you want. But that, Boozer told the youth, is BS.
You can work and achieve anything you want only with hard work, dedication, and diligence.
Martin Boozer came to Alaska from Switzerland in 1979 for what was to be a year-long adventure of learning more about the care and training of sled dogs. He's now a naturalized American citizen and lives in Big Lake with his family and 90 dogs, give or take a few. During an interview before his speech, he recalls that as a boy, his family always had a menagerie.
Including, a mouse-eating baboon spider. Most Alaskans don't know that, but I was actually an authority on turtles and tortoises. At one point in my young adult life, I knew all 280 species by botanical name and descriptions.
Early on, he learned that every species does best in its natural environment. So when he compares his fastest Iditarod time of 8 days to the early winters at 20 days...
That's less than half the time. What happened? Well, what happened is dog care. You know, it goes back to the frogs in the terrarium. They now have a perfect environment. They have perfect nutrition or ever-improving nutrition. They have ever-improving care.
Boozer has won awards for humanitarian care of his dogs.
That's compassion. That's understanding.
He says his dogs are born with drive and motivation, and he builds on that. Training starts right after birth. He carries puppies around in his shirt while he's doing chores, so they get used to his rhythm, his voice, his smell.
You know, at home, I take 30 dogs on a free run. I turn them loose and I say, if you want to go somewhere else where you can find it better, please feel free to go. So I turn the whole kennel loose and they all stick around. And I take that as a compliment.
He calls his sled dogs thoroughbred mongrels, designer dogs bred for athleticism, speed, and work. Back at Centennial Hall, Boozer regaled the youth with Iditarod and dog care stories, interspersed with advice on goal setting, hard work, and being a winner. Many of the kids fawning over the dogs after the speech said they got his message, like Corey Helgeson. He asked Boozer if he treats a team that comes in first any differently than the dogs that get the Red Lantern.
The answer was no. He didn't reward them more when he won. He rewarded them equally each and every time. I think that if I ever get a dog team, I'll treat them all equally, no matter winner or loser. Someday I hope to be in the Iditarod myself, if the Iditarod's still around then.
In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Brass in Fairbanks, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender. The Alaska Children's Trust is dedicated to preventing child abuse and neglect in Alaska. Experts tell us that when you listen, talk, and play with your child, the brain develops more fully. So listen, talk, and play. Three simple steps that add up to a brighter future for your child. The Alaska Children's Trust is committed to Alaska's children. For questions about parenting, call the Alaska Parent Line at 1-800-643-KIDS. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Children's Trust. The Alaska Public Radio Network promotes Alaska's cultures, regions, and ethnic diversity, including a commitment to informing and empowering Alaska's Native peoples.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.